Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Membership in the middle class has plummeted over the past 40 years, making the American dream out of reach for a great many Americans. Tom Hartman addresses the history, present, and possible future of this saga in his book, The Hidden History of the American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class, and How to Rescue Our Future. In addition to my visit with Tom Hartman, I'll be speaking to former history and world studies teacher Myron Buckholz, discussing the nuts and bolts of how we got here and how we can get back to a healthy and thriving American experience. We've got a wealth of insights from both Tom and Myron, so there are some 17 extra minutes beyond this broadcast that you'll find on the full, uncut version on northernspiritradio.org. We'll start out with the USA's number one progressive radio talk show host, Tom Hartman, joining us via Zoom from Portland, Oregon. Tom, so great to have you back on Spirit in Action.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for inviting me back. It's great to be here.
The newest book is The Hidden History of American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class, and How to Rescue Our Future. Our listeners may or may not have a sense of how much the middle class has decreased. How does it look to you?
Well, I open the book with the example that in the 1990s, my generation, then in our 30s or maybe early 40s, owned about 21% of the total wealth of the nation.
21.3, let's be exact here.
Thank you. You've read the book. And today, young people of that same age, that cohort, only control a little less than 5% of the total wealth of the nation. 4.6, I think, as I recall. You might have it right there in front of you.
4.6, yes.
Yeah, less than 5%. You know, this is the direct result of very specific policies put into place in 1981 by Ronald Reagan and the GOP, and 43 years of persistence in those policies that have intentionally reduced the number of people who are living the American dream, who are in the American middle class, from the two-thirds of us when Reagan came into office down to around 43% of us right now. You know, it's a fascinating story. I think you and I have talked about this before, Mark, that just very briefly, in 1951, Russell Kirk wrote this book, The Conservative Mind, in which he proposed, and at that point in time, the middle class was kind of passing through the 45% mark. We were the first nation in the world to have more than half of our population in the middle class. As a result of Franklin Roosevelt's efforts, we were at two-thirds of us in the middle class when Reagan came into office in 81. But anyhow, in 51, Russell Kirk proposed that if the middle class ever got too big, and he wasn't sure what that would be, but too big, then three things would happen. Young people would start ignoring their elders. Women would start ignoring their husbands or stop deferring to them, and minorities would forget their place in society. And the combination of these three would create a social chaos that would destroy America. You know, when he published the book in 51, Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley got all excited, but most people, even Republicans, thought he was nuts. But then came the 60s. And in 61, the birth control pill was legalized. By 64, you had a full-blown women's rights movement, the women's liberation movement. In 65, 66, you had the Vietnam War. And so by 66, 67, you had young men burning draft cards and saying, hell no, I'm not going to go. And throughout the 60s, you had the peak of the civil rights movement leading to the assassination of Dr. King and the burning of several of our large parts of several of our cities. When that happened, Republicans looked around at each other and said, holy crap, you know, Russell Kirk was right. And we've got to do something about this middle class. They thought they were seeing the disintegration of America. What in fact they were seeing was a very positive evolution toward a more egalitarian, you know, healthy, frankly, country. But they thought that it was going to be the end of our republic. And so, you know, when Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, his main commission, his job, was to gut the middle class. And that's why, you know, one of the first thing he did was take down one of only two unions that had endorsed him, or maybe three, Professional Traffic Controllers Organization, PATCO. You know, began a jeremiad against unions, put Ray Donovan in charge of the Labor Department, an anti-labor attorney, just like Trump put Anthony Scalia's son, a union-busting lawyer, in charge of the Labor Department. And they did it. They did it with tax breaks for billionaires, raising tax. Reagan raised taxes 18 times on working class people. He put a tax on Social Security income. He started enforcing the taxes on tips. He ended the deductibility of things like interest payments for car loans and credit cards. Literally 18 different ways to screw working class people to pay for this massive tax breaks for billionaires. And even at that, he threw the nation into deficit spending for the first time since World War II. And here we are, you know, now the middle class is much smaller than it used to be, and it's a real tragedy.
Do we actually have words from anyone saying that the Republicans are specifically trying to decrease the middle class? I think they wouldn't say it explicitly. Obviously, there are attacks on unions and other forms of expression, let's say, of middle class were attacked.
I think you could argue that the Powell memo, that was the subtext of the Powell memo. Or one important subtext of it. Lewis Powell also wanted to take down what he considered to be the elites, you know, the educational institutions, universities and whatnot. I don't have a Republican on tape sitting around saying, we got to destroy the middle class. But look at what they did.
I was actually admiring the ads recently where specifically Donald Trump is recorded as saying, you know, he's going to give tax cuts to his billionaire friends. You know, to make it explicit.
Yeah.
It, just in the way that Hillary was caught talking about the deplorables, there was some capturing of them saying the deadly words.
Except I don't think Democrats have done anything close to the making hay with that statement like Republicans did with Hillary. They really need to learn, how to do political assassination is probably the wrong word, but political warfare.
Well, let's talk about what middle class actually means in the U.S. And I don't know if it's the same in other countries exactly. The more governmental infrastructure you have providing for the basic needs like medical care and so on, the more you have that when you have public universities that it's free to go to. And there's Americans can go to a number of different countries and essentially get their education for free at a number of these different countries. What is it that middle class means in our society today as opposed to in 1931 when the term originated specifically?
Yeah.
Although, the meaning had been there before. The aspiration had been there before.
Sure. And interestingly, Republicans often try to redefine the American dream anyway as being you too can be Elon Musk, you know. And I would argue that the American dream historically has meant being solidly in the middle class. And the example that I use, because I think it encompasses pretty much every aspect of it, is my father. My father dropped out of college after 2 years on the GI Bill because mom got pregnant with me and went to work in a steel factory. And then when they moved to Lansing when I was born, or a year after I was born, you know, he was a door-to-door salesman for Rexair vacuum cleaners and World Book encyclopedias. He was living on the edge. He was in poverty. Finally, in 1956, when I was 5 years old, Dad got a job in a tool and die shop where he was able to join the machinists union. And suddenly the middle class, the door to the middle class opened. And, you know, the next year he bought a nice little 3-bedroom house in South Lansing, and mom and dad, and I'm the oldest of 4 boys. He was able to buy a new car every 2 years. He was able to take a vacation every year for 2 weeks. He was able to retire with a pension and travel around the world, you know, from working in a tool and die shop with basically a high school education at that point in time. I mean, he was a very smart man and in many ways a very sophisticated man. But, you know, that didn't help, you know, in trying to earn an income. It was the union that did it. It was the machines union. And he had health care throughout his life. From the time he first got that job until the day he died, he had very inexpensive, fully paid health care. At first, it was through his job, and then it was through Medicare. He had Social Security in addition to the pension from the union. So I think that, you know, freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom from need that Franklin Roosevelt talked about when he talked about a second Bill of Rights in 1944 kind of encompasses the middle class. And of course, in 1944, the middle class was just really starting to emerge in a big way in the United States. It was really in the 50s that it grew, that it really started growing fast.
Necessitous men are not free.
Are not free men. Yes, that's the quote from Franklin Roosevelt, quoting an old English judge.
So these ideas are kind of mixed up. You would say the American dream is not all that we'd be Elon Musk, but it's that we part of the middle class. We'd be free from need.
Yeah. And raise your kids and put them through school and give them a launching pad so that their lives could be even better than your life.
I went looking on the internet to see how do other countries define this, because certainly there was this international idea. I mean, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in West Africa, in Togo. My kids would like to have come to the U.S. because I think the American dream that they'd be free from need, no poverty, starvation isn't looming for them, all of that, that appealed to them, of course.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the world has seen us that way. I don't know if Europe sees us the same way. What does the American dream mean in terms of Scandinavian countries? What is their dream? Is it any different than our American dream?
You know, there's talk of the Scandinavian dream and of the European dream, but basically it's all the same thing. It's that you can have a decent life. You're not exploiting anybody. You're not, you know, ripping anybody off. You're not richer than Midas, but you're not living in poverty. You're not, you know, you won't be destroyed if you get sick, even if it's something terrible like cancer. You will be able, and your children will be able to reach their potential through education, typically, and through opportunity, that you will not end up homeless, that you will not end up hungry. You know, this is pretty straightforward stuff. And I think there's pretty much a consensus around the world that these are basic necessities. This is one of the great accomplishments, frankly, of China over the last couple of decades, is bringing almost a billion people into the middle class. No other country in the world has done that so fast. And of course, they did it by basically deindustrializing America, moving our and much of Europe's factories directly into China as a result of the neoliberal policies that we adopted in the 80s and 90s. And Europe did too at the same time, or much of Europe did. But, you know, that's a completely different culture with a completely different language and a completely different history and a different system of government. But still, people will say, you know, hey, I'll go along with the Chinese Communist Party as long as all of these basic needs are met. Now, you know, here we have the freedom to speak out and criticize our government. I'm not positing that as part of the American dream. I think that's just part of America. I think that's part of democracy and freedom. I'm viewing the American dream largely through an economic lens, rather.
So what is the definition of middle class, and does China have a bigger middle class than the U.S. now?
China has a bigger middle class than the entire population of the United States, yeah.
I mean, in terms of number, percentage-wise is what I was referring to.
I don't recall. It's been a couple of years since I paid much attention to the size of the middle class in China. There was a great series of articles about it in the Financial Times maybe 2 years ago that was really enlightening and startling, but I don't remember the numbers from it. I'm sorry. I just remember that they made the point that there are now more Chinese in the middle class than there are Americans, period.
I was trying to read critically your book, The Hidden History of the American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class and How to Rescue Our Future. And I was trying to look at all of the factors that could be considered. You consider so many of them so well in just 150 pages, you do an amazing amount of analysis. So you can't dot every I and cross every T in terms of analyzing this. But you mentioned under Reagan that we started running a deficit, growing a very significant deficit. That's also union busting is going on around there. Also women at that time, it was really in the late 70s, early 80s that we go from one earner households to two. And cause and effect is sometimes hard to figure out. But all of those things contribute to a decreasing middle class, I think.
Yeah, it takes 2.3 people now, you know, working full time to provide the same standard of living that one person in 1981 working full time could provide. And that, you know, again, this is the consequence of neoliberalism, of, you know, Reaganism, of Reagan's policies. So it's even worse than it seems. You know, it's not just that we went from, you know, 2/3 of us to 43% of us. It's that to maintain that 43%, it requires two people instead of one, which is pretty grim stuff. And now you've got, you know, the cost of childcare on top of that, which is just really whacking some families.
A contrary point that I came up with, you and I both went through college, did a lot of development of our lives when it was considerably cheaper. But one of the reasons it was cheaper is we did more of it on our own. We didn't all have cars in college. I got halfway through college because I was working in a place 20 miles away. The amount of housing, I grew up in a family of 12 kids, so I have an unusual situation. But I looked up online, and in 1950s, the average housing was 292 square feet per person. And in the 2010s, that was 924. So like three times as much, at least. Housing. Everyone's got their cell phone. Everyone's got their car. There's a number of ways in which the need bar has been raised quite a bit. And then medical care, even. I expect medical care that I would never expected when I was 20 years old. I think that's true. But I think that makes it difficult to judge what's middle class because it's based on needs, but our needs are assumed to be greater. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. It's an excellent point. And, you know, back in the 80s, this was another thing that I noticed that came along with the Reagan Revolution, is that prior to Reagan's presidency, most television programs, the dramas and the sitcoms, showed working class people in working class homes. You know, Mary Tyler Moore and Dick Van Dyke in an apartment, even though he was the head writer for a television program. I mean, today those people live in very fancy houses. Bewitched with Elizabeth Montgomery. Her husband was an astronaut, as I recall, wasn't he? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And there was another program where the husband was an advertising executive. No, that was Bewitched. Her husband was an advertising executive, wasn't he?
Right.
Yeah. I'm thinking of I Dream of Jeannie. I'm sorry. Mixing up my 60s programs. And Bewitched in particular, because here's a guy who's the vice president of a Madison Avenue ad agency. Vice presidents of Madison Avenue agencies today take home, you know, I mean, they started $1 million a year. And this guy's living in a suburban two-bedroom house, you know. We had these kind of comfortable standards in the 50s and 60s and 70s. But then what happened was suddenly, you know, you had Dallas and Dynasty. And I remember Murphy Brown and there were several of the other sitcoms where suddenly you were seeing these people in multi-million dollar houses or million dollar houses. You know, very nice, very elegant houses. And it's been that way pretty much ever since. You know, with the exception maybe of Seinfeld, we really haven't seen a Jackie Gleason or Lucille Ball, you know, living in an apartment, you know, in a third floor cold water walk-up apartment kind of living situation in our media in a long, long time. And there was a fascinating study that I've never been able to track down, but I remember it so vividly. It was in the 70s, and I was living in Michigan, and I heard it on WKAR, on the NPR station out of MSU, out of East Lansing. These researchers had taken a bunch of squirrels' nests on one of the campuses or in this nearby forest and increased the size of the nests by about 20%, just gone and added a bunch of leaves to the squirrels' nests, you know, randomly to see what would happen. And what happened was all the other squirrels started increasing the size of their nests. Like there's some sort of, you know, keep up with the Joneses thing that's built into our DNA that probably has to do with survival. You know, that you need to build a bigger nest if you think it's going to be a really harsh winter, for example, or depending on where you are in the country or, you know, what latitude. So I think that seeing all of this wretched excess in the 80s and seeing it celebrated, you know, in movies and on television, and frankly, for the 40 years since then, drives people to think that they have to live in a 3,000 square foot or a 2,000 square foot house rather than a 900 square foot apartment or house.
You know, something else that happened through the 70s and 80s, 90s, certainly has continued on, is the lottery idea. It's about this morbid affluence. We all can be Elon Musk, as you said, you know.
Yeah, you too can be a millionaire.
Yeah, who wants to be a millionaire?
Yeah, and there was Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, you know, it was a big show.
Right.
Donald Trump, you know, Apprentice.
Right.
Celebrate wealth in this country, or we have since the Reagan Revolution. We didn't used to celebrate wealth. If you look at the television programs in the 50s and 60s, and even the 70s, they did not celebrate wealth.
Daddy Warbucks, Orphan Annie? I mean.
Oh, they ridiculed wealth.
Right, of course. That's what I was thinking. That a whole change in thinking. Now, I don't know if is that a Republican way of thinking, or I think most people went along with it pretty easily because who doesn't want to be filthy rich?
Yeah, could be. I mean, we're an aspirational society, and that is something that Reagan and the GOP really hooked into in the 80s and exploited, I think.
Yeah. The increasing amount of credit. I remember in the early 80s that grocery stores would not take credit cards.
Yep.
There were places you could take them, but not grocery stores. Oh, my God. That's.
You had to write a check or pay cash. Yeah.
Yeah. And now the increase of that or get your paycheck early. I've been a little bit appalled. I sometimes watch the Late Show online and the ads, about 2/3 of them seem to be about here. You can get your credit score so you can borrow money. You don't have to wait till tomorrow to get the new thing that you want to do.
Right. Instant gratification.
Yeah. I think that's a significant problem. So the middle class, the American dream, How hopeful are you that we're going to go in a good direction there?
Well, we'll find out in 30 some odd days. I mean, if Donald Trump is elected, he's made it very clear that he wants to give more tax breaks to billionaires and try to destroy the unions. Kamala Harris has made it very clear that she and Joe Biden over the last 3.5 years have rejected neoliberalism. They've even rejected the Democratic embrace of it. They're no longer with Bill Clinton on free trade. They're no longer with Barack Obama on, you know, tax cuts and things like that. And they're going full FDR. I see that as an incredibly optimistic thing. I mean, the changes that they've made in the economy in 3.5 years have enabled us to, so far, survive the Fed cranking up interest rates in ways that every other time they've done this, going all the way back to the 50s, have produced a recession. So, I mean, we'll still see if we get a recession, but so far, soft landing. And it's because of what they've done. It's because of it's cost several $1 trillion, but they have rebuilt basically the supports for the middle class that existed prior to the 1980s. It's a good thing.
One of the things that I find myself of at least two minds about is tariffs. Donald Trump actually was using tariffs. Part of my mindset had been increasingly diverted to think, no, free trade's a good idea. We don't want exporting jobs so they can pollute and mistreat workers there. But working with the countries like the European Union has done, that seems like a good idea. Get rid of those barriers. Tariffs, on the other hand, seem to have some positive effect. How do you feel about tariffs?
Tariffs built America. You know, Alexander Hamilton proposed tariffs in 1791 with his report on manufacturers, his 11-point plan. It's sometimes called the American Plan. President Washington and Congress adopted them. They were so successful that tariffs paid 100% of the cost of the federal government right up until the Civil War. 2/3 of the cost of the federal government right up to World War I, and 1/3 of the cost of the federal government up through World War II. Tariffs kept our domestic manufacturing within the United States. Trump is right about the importance of tariffs. He's wrong about how to do them. He just came in like a bull in a china shop and started slapping tariffs on things. And you don't do it that way. I mean, tariffs are a tax. You raise taxes for two reasons. One is to generate revenue, but the more important one is to alter behavior. And what tariffs do is they cause business people to say, you know, I should build that factory here in the United States rather than, you know, importing things from Taiwan or China, because I don't want to have to pay the tariff. I can do it just for the same price or even less here in the United States. But before somebody's going to build a factory, before they're going to invest millions of dollars in building a factory, they need to know that that tariff is going to be there for the next 2 decades. Tariffs need to be imposed in a careful, gradual, thoughtful, publicly transparent fashion with widespread approval across the country, rather than just this, oh yeah, we'll slap kind of stuff like Trump did. I mean, all that does is start trade wars, and it cost us a couple $100 billion where he had to reimburse farmers for being the victims of the trade war with China that he'd started. So I'm a fan of tariffs, and I think that the Harris campaign is making a mistake when they refer to tariffs as sales taxes. I think that they should also be saying, yes, we support tariffs as well, because Biden has. Biden has imposed a couple of dozen tariffs on things just in the last 3 years, and substantial tariffs. I mean, 100% tariff on some cars, on electric cars coming from China, for example. And these are brand new tariffs. And he has retained a number of Trump's old tariffs. But I'm not an advisor to her campaign, so I should not.
Well, maybe you and I should get together and contact them.
There you go. But I think people get.
There's so much more that we could talk about. I always love my time with you. I love the time in the book. When we're talking about the American dream, you talk about your own experience with successive companies, your own personal lived experience about it. That's invaluable in terms of understanding how this really works. Your chapters on what it takes to build a middle class and that housing should not be a commodity. People have to pick up the book, The Hidden History of American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class, How to Rescue Our Future by Tom Hartman. You can track it down anywhere on the net, but go via hartmanreport.com, which, of course, I have linked on northernspiritradio.org. It's a quick read for a lot of knowledge. And I can't help but believe that you, Tom, are a force pushing our country in a sane and safe, healthy direction. I think the middle class would grow if only they would listen to you. So let's have more people listen to you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining me, and we'll be in touch soon.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Tom Hartman, website hartmanreport.com, linked, of course, on my site, nordenspiritradio.org, with all of my Spirit in Action and Song of the Soul guests of the past 19 years. There are riches on my site for the seeing and listening. When you visit, please post a comment and enrich us further with your reactions, insights, and experience. Also, check out the 35-plus community radio stations that carry our shows all across the United States and help them thrive and grow and further serve our cities and towns. We're needing your help right now to also keep Northern Spirit Radio thriving, as we're short on donations to get us to our annual major fundraiser at the end of the year. You can help us pay our bills this month by donating either online or via mail on northernspiritradio.org. Right now, let's hustle back to the second part of our discussion about the American dream and the middle class, this time speaking with former history and world studies teacher and a friend of mine, Myron Buckholz. And we'll start out our visit on his back porch in Eau Claire with a gentle wind, abundant birds, and a bubbling fish pond. Myron, it's good to finally have you back on Spirit in Action.
It's a pleasure to be here, I think.
Yes, I know. It always tests your abilities, your patience to be sitting with me. First of all, we're going to be talking about the American dream and about middle class and Tom Hartman, who I just finished talking to. What's your impression of Tom Hartman?
He's an American genius. He's just amazing. He just nails it. We are very much alike, I think. I mean, I think like he does.
So in your years of teaching history, of course, you're driving on the kind of history that is part and parcel of what Tom Hartman does. What he says there's basis for. Did you ever use him or his material in any particular way in your classes?
No, I used a lot of original source material. And sometimes, and of course, I've been out for 10 years, but it's one of my regrets that I didn't do more with sources like this. When I start to chastise myself, I think, where would I have found the time? Because, well, it's one of my complaints about that fits with the demise of the middle class is what we've done in education and with time. Everything's so compressed, it was difficult to add more. But that being said, I wish I would have.
Now, you grew up in North Dakota, and I have a feeling your family was solidly middle class. I'm not quite positive about that because I know there's a lot of differences in how your family dynamics played out. But this book, the most recent book by Tom Hartman, The Hidden History of the American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class, and How to Rescue Our Future, you lived through the transition, as did I, as the middle class started to wane. End of the 70s, beginning of 80s, certainly with the Reagan Revolution or the Reagan de-evolution, the changes that happened there in the middle class. Did you see it happen in your environment?
I'm a walking, talking legacy to the Great Society. My family started out to be small farmers, like so many in North Dakota, and I was really young when that happened. My biggest memory is my father became a postmaster, and it doesn't matter what size of town, postmasters are well paid, and they just unionized. At the same time that he entered, he was an acting postmaster, I think, from 67 until 70, and then made full postmaster. For me, that meant a $20 bill on payday, you know, twice a month, and gas in the car. Never wanted for anything. It wasn't extravagant. You know, if my dad's job as a postmaster could have been one of many, many other jobs, union jobs, that meant for a comfortable lifestyle. So I had plenty of time to shoot baskets.
You lived in North Dakota until you moved to Eau Claire in the late 90s. So you got to see two different environments. Now, of course, the environment changed at that point, but also you started teaching history and world studies when you moved here. Please describe the coursework that you were responsible for there.
The one thing that I consistently taught through all 18 years here was sophomore world studies. The U.S. history that I taught, certainly the AP U.S. history, we went through many of the topics because undeniable, and of course I lived it, the U.S. history aspect of it definitely closer, but I didn't teach U.S. history every year.
So what we're talking about here is American Dream. you know, the progressive era that was really ending around then, leading into FDR and the whole transformation of society that was. You teach all of that kind of thing. And when you got to the Reagan Revolution and you're teaching about that, could you already be teaching in school here about the decline of the American dream or the decline of the middle class in America?
No, certainly not directly. I left in 2015. There was an emphasis on struggle and moving forward, because the examples are plenty of the great breakthroughs of the progressive era and, you know, progressively getting better. And you can list off the amendments and different changes that happened. So is growth of the middle class. See, this is the thing. Then we get to the 1980s and I start teaching. So I grow up in this growth and I start teaching, and I'm Ronald Reagan. My first job in 1981, and he is president, and we're being bombarded with trickle down. We're with the end, I think, of the second Gilded Age, and I taught that all the time. And we are at the beginning, somewhere in the new progressive era. And when I was asked by my students what was my favorite era of history, I would always say the progressive era. Post-Civil War, the accumulation of wealth went on the fast track. And so people only got their steel from Carnegie and Rockefeller and oil, you know, and the banking was all a handful of the names. That type of wealth accumulation went crazy. And of course, it's on the backs of the American worker. You talk about opinion and things all you want. You should look back in that era, and people worked themselves to death. And the few people at the top got incredibly wealthy and powerful. That had to come to an end, because they could not keep doing what they were doing and treating the American population in general as they were disposable. You know, they simply were. If you died, it matters not to me. Be some more coming off the boat, which for a current event thing is, you know, they relied on immigration constantly, more workers, cheaper workers, and didn't care if they died. Well, you can make that argument that we have people like that today on a bigger stage, in a bigger way than we might like to think. I'd like to think that I taught it without teaching it, that the story is being told when there's time to tell that story, that makes the point that for all of the growth and all of the progress, there is the underside that you don't get sometimes in your history book. That's what I hope I did.
The Industrial Revolution led to a total changing of economies, concentration. I was wondering if the middle class was perhaps the largest in the U.S. before the Industrial Revolution, because then I guess I'm kind of assuming at that point there weren't the equivalent of robber barons before the Industrial Revolution started concentrating and providing convenient ways to siphon wealth from a lot of people into the pockets of few.
There was a little thing called slavery, which dominated a significant chunk of our history. And then, of course, agriculture, because the great majority of people grew the food they ate. I would get asked sometimes about my time machine. And if somebody sent me back, what time period would I choose between, let's say, typical European Middle Ages of 1300 to 1500 or so, and be a peasant, or into Boston in 1840, 1860, and be a poor Irishman. Hands down, I would take peasant in some part of Europe, because sun goes down, you go to sleep, you grow your own food. Obviously, there are some downsides. But the Industrial Revolution, as it kicked in, you know, you can work 18 hours a day, literally be worked to death. And so I would choose peasantry in its short and brutish lifespan over being an immigrant in our early Industrial Revolution, have a short and brutish lifespan.
Yeah, it is really interesting, especially with the motto these days, make America great again. I've loved the interviews I've seen when you talk to people. So when was America great? And they'll say the 1950s. So it was pretty great, except for there was the whole civil rights thing going on. Oh, well, there's that. Well, and what about back 200 years ago? Well, there was slavery, and the great portion people frequently don't look at the downsides.
Certainly our history books don't look at the downside. The theme in your standard history book that's used all across the country is one of progress and growth. As I taught, it got better, that there could be paragraphs But one of my glaring examples is in the book that we used for ninth grade history compared to the book that I used for AP history and similar years, had much more in it. The ninth grade history book had more in it about Kent State and the Pentagon Papers than my AP U.S. history book did. It was, if I recall, only a couple of paragraphs about the Pentagon Papers. And then if using the Vietnam thing as an example, the Gulf of Tonkin had almost a full page. And if you read it without knowing, you know, and not getting a pretty solid education about how that didn't work out, you could read it and think, oh, this was justified. Those dirty Vietnamese shot at us right off their coastline where we have every right to be. Well, we're shooting at them. So, but this becomes a crisis in the theme. And I think the tone of how it's written about in history books, which aren't written by historians, you know, that James Lowen, now deceased and my favorite historian, made that painfully obvious to me a few times. I got to talk to him and they put their names on them because it looks good. Thomas Kennedy, I think, was my AP history book, and that was considered the grand poobah of AP history books. He didn't write it, and Lowen challenged him on it and got him to basically admit it. So the emphasis is on the growth, and if you have a teacher who just wants to emphasize that, there will be very little. And I saw teachers do that. I heard from my students coming back from other classes that, gee, we got a little bit of a different version a couple times. We said, yeah, let's leave out something here and there, emphasize something here and there. We change the version pretty quickly. That's how somebody hears it. That's why I wanted to make my time machine work. I never did. It was a great idea because I want to take my students back and actually have them breathe the air and live in a period of time that can be written about and make you feel like it's all Little House on the Prairie. It was the death of the middle class.
Well, let's talk about what's happened to the middle class. Again, you're thinking that perhaps we're near the end of the Second Gilded Age and maybe a whole new progressive era. Back when Jesse Jackson ran for president, I think it was 1984, I had no thought that our country would ever mature enough to have a black president. So to have it happen in 2008 was far and above my hopes or expectations. Gay marriage, as you said, I had no idea that we'd get to that in any reasonable time. So I'm very impressed with some steps we've made. That having been said, the military budget has only grown throughout. I guess there was a dip in the spending on military back in the 1990s. There's so many things that have continued badly. And ever since what I saw happen with Newt Gingrich in the 1990s, with the Tea Party 2010, and then this whole movement that's around Donald Trump from 2015-16, I don't feel terribly optimistic. So let's talk about the decline of the middle class. And to talk about the specifics of the decline of the middle class, we're going to now move from Myron Buchholz's Back Porch and its bird song and wind chimes to a more sound neutral space. Myron, what would you like to address in terms of the evidence for and the mechanisms of the decline of the middle class?
When my friends ask me about this topic in a current event sense, my stock answer is 40 years of propaganda. Over 40 years ago, Ronald Reagan lied to the American people about tax cuts, and tax cuts were going to make a big difference in your everyday life. His budget director at the time, David Stockman, shortly after the trickle-down craziness is being promoted by our corporate media, admitted that it doesn't work. But that doesn't matter, because in a current sense, every politician on that side of the issues talks tax cuts ad nauseum, and it simply hasn't worked. The proof in the pudding for me is the gap between CEO pay and worker pay. And I believe it's something like 230 some times what a worker makes now, when before this craziness of the Reagan era kicked in, it was much, much closer.
I think as part of your work as a history and a world studies teacher, you had to address some of what happened with the unions, all of the places that guaranteed that our wages were better. Certainly, we all know about the air traffic controllers union that Ronald Reagan subverted. How big was the decline in labor unions from, say, the 1970s up until today?
What I recall is the peak of our unionized workforce was somewhere in the mid-30%, and now it's somewhere around 10. That 30% had that carryover effect that meant that other jobs that weren't unionized benefited from the fact that employers had to pay that wonderful living union wage to attract good workers if they weren't unionized. They drove it down to 10% and just absolutely vilified the union model, the union idea. And of course, with driving it down that much, it takes its toll on other jobs. Other employers no longer have to pay. They're not in competition to keep a worker from going to a union job. And it shows up again in the depressed middle class. I hate to demean an octopus, these tentacles that go off into so many different directions when you start talking about this last 40 years, because as you just mentioned, you know, the union issue is another one. And one of the things I would like to do is go back to that air traffic controller strike and be powerful enough to have every union in the country stop. Every union in the country should have went on strike when Reagan threatened to fire those air traffic controllers. And we should have shut this country down for a day or two, because with that 40 years of propaganda, the bashing of unions is another one of those lies that goes along with tax cuts and on and on and on to the point to ending up where we are today.
So one of the mechanisms of the decline of the middle class was tax cuts. Another one is unions. Any other specific modes of destruction of the middle class that have been used?
Well, I mentioned earlier, you know, medical costs. We've already talked about that. And then college costs. So the American dream is to become educated beyond high school, professional license, and so on. And sometimes those things are driven out of the range of people's ability to advance themselves. We spend a tremendous amount of our wealth on military. The Reagan Revolution, and I really don't like using that term, largest peacetime military buildup in history. And of course, the lie that continues today is that, well, it brought down the Berlin Wall. Well, the political science people who are watching Eastern Europe closely knew that the Soviets could not continue. Their system was not going to work for much longer. And of course, they bankrupted themselves in Afghanistan and it fell apart. Yet Reagan's speechwriter gave him a great soundbite, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. And that is still repeated by many as the thing that did it in that simplistic view of human history. We love the soundbite. And so military spending is completely out of whack. I always enjoy seeing articles about China growing their military. And my question is, how many aircraft carriers do they have? Oh, one. How many do we have? 12 super carriers. And that doesn't count our World War II size carriers that the Marines have, because I think that's like 18. Nobody touches us militarily. And shifting a little bit of our wealth from the military to the civilian population would pay dividends. And look what Biden has done with the different bills that they were able to get through Congress by the skin of their teeth, even after they were watered down. But those things pumped money into the middle class, and inflation is down, and our economic numbers are looking up coming out of a pandemic and an economic crash. So it works. If Elon Musk takes a couple billion from his $200 billion and pumps it into the middle class, the effect would be instantaneous all across the country.
I do wonder what the effect has been of privatization of the work done formerly by government. I think in the military, the number of contractors now that we hand money, that certainly happened in Iraq. A lot of our work was outsourced to people who were paid much higher prices and took a lot of our budget, rather than going to employees of the federal government. That outsourcing, I think, has got to have inflated government spending at the same time that conservatives claim they're trying to save us money by outsourcing.
The Pentagon can't be audited. There are estimates that goes into the hundreds of billions of dollars that nobody can account for. That alone is just damning. The example that I use with people is when my daughter was spending some of her 27 months in Baghdad, fighting a war that did nothing positive. Well, I know we can't come to grips with that because we don't like to use the word lose. It took us about 10 years to admit that in Vietnam, that we did lose. We don't win these wars. Define win to me. Well, my daughter's in Baghdad. One of her acquaintances is driving a tank. And when they get back to the base, the dining facility is closed because the dining facility is only open for so many hours. And Halliburton runs the dining facility. And they're not paying people. Third world nationals who are working there and hardly making any money at all. But yet they're taking money to feed our soldiers. You have to be there when it's open. It makes my hair stand up a little bit when I tell that story because it's just maddening. So, yes, it's just another thread that you can follow. We are the richest country in the world. I can't stop saying that because it needs to be driven home. And we can afford things that make an average American's life much better. And yet, because of all of this history and these lies that have been promoted, it's always a fight. It's absolutely a fight. And there were Democrats in Congress. And one of the things I have here in my notes is the absence of a loyal opposition, as the term is kind of used in parliamentary settings. So many of the Democrats over the course of that 40 years caved. And if they just caved in completely or they kept quiet or did not fight back enough, you know, let this economic snowball roll down until it's crushing to the middle class. The optimism that I have is that we are at the bottom of a cycle. And I have been telling people that I remember helping my parents staple up signs for Lyndon Johnson in 1964 when I was 6 years old. And I hung a sign this year for Kamala Harris, and I'm 66 years old. And it's the second time in my life that I hung up a sign for a presidential candidate. And I'm hoping that we get the same economic boost that we got from Johnson's Great Society, which moved our middle class. The gap between the haves and have-nots was the smallest in American history for a period of time through the 60s and the 70s. That got reversed out of panic that people that don't deserve help were getting it, and the color issue, and poverty issue, and lazy issue that they're so good at convincing the working class to vote for people who do not actually have their best interests in mind. And so I'm hoping that at the end of my life, I get to live through a little bit of a progressive era. And I hope that Kamala Harris doesn't squander her good work in a foreign war like LBJ squandered his legacy in Vietnam.
Actually, one of the things I recall, you were living in North Dakota back in the day, Myron. I was in Wisconsin at the point when Senator William Proxmire was here. And each month he had his Golden Fleece Award. And so he complained about $800 hammers that the military was producing. And that had to do, again, with how you source them and regulations and all of that kind of thing. And I'm afraid it's only gotten worse, and there's no one calling out the fleecing of the U.S. public by the outsourcing that we do.
Earlier, I mentioned that there is no audit of our Defense Department. And I remember Proxmire really well. One of the arguments I made in the $800 or $600 hammer thing came up was, well, who's charging that? You're blaming the government. Politicians, the lies coming out of the Reagan administration in that horrible quote of Ronald Reagan, that the scariest words in American history is, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. The bashing of good government, the tearing down of good government, making it sound corrupt when it was actually working, when it actually works pretty well, is horrible. So you have private companies. Well, if I can get away with charging $600 for a hammer, I'm probably going to do it. Maybe I'm just not so morally pure as I think I am, huh? But I just admitted to that.
I wouldn't do it, Myron.
You wouldn't. I'm leaning towards, yeah, maybe a couple hammers here, hammer there, and, you know, pretty soon you're pretty well off. It was private companies that were charging, and the lack of oversight is a weakness. That's true. But to tear down government because of some bad examples hurt the middle class, because, you know, the negative parts of trickle down. And, you know, another part of it that I always bring up is our corporate media has also sold out. You know, it wasn't just the politicians lying. It was our corporate media picking up on what they were saying and foisting it on people so that it soaks in. It ends up with a point where we are a tremendously divided nation.
And that's why when I do my fundraising pitch for Northern Spirit Radio, I point out that now our media is controlled. I think maybe five different major corporations control something like 90% of the media in this country. That's the last number I recall. That's why you need alternative sources like community radio and Northern Spirit Radio and so many other good alternative sources.
Exactly. I had a poster from Mother Jones magazine 20 years ago, and I put up, it was a nice color poster that showed all the companies that did exist and how they had been funneled down into the, I think, 8 or 9 at the time. It's even less than that now. So it's just a constant funneling towards an oligarchy that is only interested in lining our pockets, and they hoard money, and it's hurting us.
So that's another mechanism of the decline of the middle class. How much do you think the middle class has declined in your experience? And I'm talking again about the experience of Myron Buckles as a history teacher, as a keen analyst of world politics. What other evidence do you think you have of the decline of middle class?
Personally, I have weathered the storm pretty well. You know, that is one of the things that I have to accept as when I complain that people can say, well, you've done okay. However, I started out qualifying for food assistance as a teacher in North Dakota. And then I had the good fortune of moving to Wisconsin, and especially Eau Claire, a wealthier school district, in 1997. And my pay skyrocketed. So I could always have sympathy for the teachers back in the Great Plains who were struggling. And I know what average teacher pay is across the country, and it simply isn't. It doesn't hold up with what much in the private industry and so on. And then, of course, the attack is on public schools in general. That's a big fear that I have with the death of the middle class, is the attack on public schools, having less and less resources for more and more students. And what's the outcome of that going to be? It's going to be ignorance. The autocrats love ignorance. And Donald Trump said, I love the poorly educated. How is a person supposed to interpret that? I'd love the poorly educated. So, you know, it's difficult, and it is for people, and certainly a, you know, significant number of the workforce has a hard time relating or seeing, experiencing, or feeling what a great percentage of our workforce go through. Empathy. It's nice to have empathy. It's nice to know. One of the blurbs on Fox News that I remember hearing way back in the early part of the century was, our poor really aren't that poor because they have refrigerators. And I guess if you have a house, you do. And is keeping food cold in the richest country in the world really an indicator of how well off we are? Your bar is pretty low. And then, of course, people on welfare buy steaks and buy all kinds of things. And it convinces people that have just a little bit more to despise people who have a little bit less, and drives that wedge, which they have used so well, to make us attack each other.
In spite of that, you still seem to be optimistic about the future of our country?
We are the richest country in the world. And as such, if we harness a little bit of that wealth, we can do some amazing things. I choose to be optimistic over pessimistic because the other direction is unthinkable. And there is a certain ebb and flow to history, and we've seen it in American history before. When my students ask me what is my favorite era in American history, I would say the Progressive Era. I always have to remind people and remind myself that that played out over 30 or 40 years. And then we got a number of changes that really did pave the way for the eventual great society dream of Lyndon Johnson. But it doesn't happen overnight. And I'm at a stage in my life where I'm hoping I got enough left where I can watch a positive change unfurl, because we have the ability to do it if we just have the will.
Well, I'm glad to have you working for that better future through the ways you write. I think our newspaper locally has benefited tremendously from your letters to the editor. I think your run for Congress, the Democratic nomination by the office formerly held by Ron Kind, that was a positive step that you took. And I always love being out there at the peace stand with you, amongst many other things that you do that are good in this world. And I thank you for bringing your knowledge, your insight, and your witness to our country, including your sharing here today for Spirit in Action.
Thanks for the time, Mark, and thanks for all you do, too.
Again, folks, that was Myron Buckles. We started out the hour with Tom Hartman, and there are links to both of them and the book, The Hidden History of the American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class, on northernspiritradio.org. And we'll see you all next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.